Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Welcome back to the show. Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, and Sandra Bland. When you say these names, they're not just the names of those that died either at the hands of the police or while in police custody. They became a national rallying cry and a way to shine a spotlight on police brutality brought against people of color that's become normalized in the United States. And yes, one of those names belongs to a woman. In particular, Sandra Bland's death after being pulled over for what started as a small traffic violation in a Texas town sparked the hashtag #SayHerName, which sought to ensure that her death wouldn't become just another statistic, but also a way of making sure that Sandra Bland's life was remembered and that this tragedy could evoke real change. Now, a new documentary by Academy Award-nominated husband and wife filmmakers David Heilbronner and Kate Davis takes a close look at Sandra Bland's life, her political activism, and her family in their pursuit of answers about why Bland was found dead in her jail cell 3 days after her arrest. Let's play a clip from the trailer, which explains some of the questions that Sandra Bland's family and their lawyer had about her death.
The Texas Rangers, they walked us through footage, so they claimed anyway, of the jail. We were looking, trying to see where Sandy was. I didn't see her ever.
The video that we viewed when we went down, it was only for the morning of Monday, July 13th. There's no timestamps, there's no dates. Her cell was all the way in the back corner. She was in cell number 95.
The way they choose it to phrase it is where she was did not have cameras. But I would think that that would be strange. And how are you monitoring your inmates?
Why was she in a cell by herself? That's a big cell for one person. And when they were wheeling the gurney out, I went, whoa, she's gonna be on the gurney, right? Oh no, she wasn't on the gurney.
The film is titled Say Her Name, The Life and Death of Sandra Bland. It premiered yesterday on HBO. It'll be playing again this Thursday, Sunday, and next Tuesday, as well as on demand. And we're very glad to have Kate Davis and David Heilbronner in the studio. Welcome, you guys.
Thank you.
And full disclosure, I did an event with you guys for a short time last week with one of Sandra Bland's sisters for HBO. So we've met before.
Yes, we have. People
to know. So you were in touch with the Bland family within weeks of Sandra's death. Kate, what were those initial conversations like?
Oh, my goodness. Well, within, I think it was about 7 days, roughly after Sandra passed, HBO contacted us and said, would we like to pursue this? And, of course, the video of her arrest or takedown on the side of the street by Officer Encinia had gone viral. So we knew of the case, and the question was, in part, whether the family would be open to having a feature-length film made about their daughter and sister. And so David flew up to Chicago and met with them.
Yeah, I mean, and you have to remember, at the time we contacted them, you know, Sandy had died just a week before, 10 days before. It was an international news story. The family was deluged with reporters and paparazzi. They couldn't go outside. It was awful. And so to come in as a filmmaker and ask, gee, can we follow you around? You know, when you ask, what was it like? And it was incredibly awkward, and it was hard to explain that we thought, you know, no noble intentions. And I think the family got that. They looked up our work and said, yeah, you know, come along for this ride. And it was actually really brave of them. That was a tough time for them.
But I think what they wanted to do above all, and we all as a team, you know, wanted to ensure that Sandra's story had longevity, that here we are 3 years later examining it close up, you know, because we were on the inside for several years of investigation. So there are a lot of dramatic twists and turns that people, the public really doesn't know about. That Sandy herself is one of the biggest voices in the film, as you know, and her message can still be heard and she can still inspire people to stand up to truth. Stand up for truth, stand up to power.
Yeah. David, you mentioned that they had looked up your work, and for folks who don't know the work that you've done, what kind of films had you been worked on previously?
How could they not know our work? Oh, no. yeah, there are a million films out there. We've done we've been doing sort of civil rights films for about 20 years. Kate made a film called Southern Comfort, which was about trans people. We did a film recently called The Newburgh Sting about the FBI targeting American Muslims. We did a film called Stonewall Uprising about the birth of the gay power movement. You know, civil rights has been a space that we feel we have something to contribute to. And so the family looked it up, and we explained, you know, we think this case could be of historical importance, if you will, and it's worth documenting what happens on a real-time basis. So they let us in right at the beginning, and we were able to film things that were extremely emotionally sensitive, and the family was open enough to let us do that and let us make them part of the film.
One of the things that Sandra's sisters have said is that they saw the media narrative starting to be to be woven about their sister, with people who had never even met their sister. When you first got there, what was the media narrative about Sandra Bland? Do you remember?
Yeah, I mean, the local Texas authorities had engaged in essentially a character assassination campaign against Sandy. And so they said, it was likely that she had ingested a large amount of marijuana in jail, which would explain her volatile moods. She had been severely depressed before, making her a likely suicide candidate. She had a criminal record. You know, the list of negatives about her was the narrative they wanted to put forth to the public. And the family was really pissed off about it, because that was not the Sandy they knew. It was not the Sandy that all her friends knew. I mean, I could go on about it.
But in fact, they had a second autopsy performed, which, as you'll see in the film, you know, lends credibility to the idea that she didn't have marijuana, any kind of fresh marijuana in her system, and that was just, you know, a smokescreen, so that the public perception is to even unconsciously blame the victim and not look at the larger forces that helped bring her down.
We're talking to David Heilbrunner and Kate Davis, the filmmakers behind Say Her Name, the documentary about the life and death of Sandra Bland. So just so people who aren't steeped in this, Kate, tell us what the authorities say happened, and then David, tell us what the family thinks might have happened.
Okay. Well, the authorities at the start, they claimed, I will say Officer Insignia, who was the arresting officer, claimed that he was attacked physically by Sandra, and that's why he slapped a felony on her. Now, we have a lot of proof to the contrary, because there not only was a dash cam where, you know, you can watch for full real time all the minutes of the arrest, and she never assaults him. And there was also a bystander video, by chance, a guy on the street who, with his cell phone, films the officer's knee in her back. She's sort of yelling and saying she's in pain. And the idea that she, you know, deserved a felony for what? Answering a few questions correctly, and without attitude when he asked her, you know, is she okay? And, you know, is she done? Would she mind putting her cigarette out? Well, yes, I would mind. You know, she just answered his questions before he sort of finally escalated the situation to the point where he asked her to get out of the car with a taser. So the authorities painted a picture in which she was violent. That's for starters. And then in the jail, according to, you know, the Texas police and you know, the sheriff's office, Sandra was placed in solitary confinement and just kind of 3 days later was found hung by a trash bag in her cell, and that she was probably, you know, just felt isolated because she was abandoned by the family who had not come in and bailed her out. That was another part of their story.
Yeah, I mean, the authorities basically said we didn't do anything wrong. They had an investigation where the only wrongdoing they could find was the reason that Officer Insignia, Trooper Insignia, the guy on the scene arresting her for a traffic violation, pulled her out of her car at taser point. You know, so that's what the authorities say. Everything was fine. Everything was by the book. What the family said and what the family discovered is that, you know, the trooper assaulted Sandy by the roadside. Their autopsy showed she had, you know, bruised ribs, badly scratched up, you know, beaten up. She was put held in jail on a bogus felony charge of assaulting the officer, held in solitary confinement for 3 days against protocol. She was held for 3 days without being reevaluated and being reintroduced to general population. She was held in a cell with no video camera at all. And then finally, the family discovered that people who were supposed to check on her on regular intervals had falsified the jail logs and they hadn't checked on her at all. They just filled in the numbers and went about their business. So the whole notion of, that the authorities are still putting out is that basically we did everything right. Is, and I think the film supports the family. I think the evidence that's come out supports the conclusion that a whole lot of things were done wrong. And there's a sad and kind of creepy racist tinge about this entire event. This is an empowered black woman in the deep south of Texas in a mostly white police system. And she's treated like dirt, you know, right from the beginning and all throughout her incarceration. And I contend if she were a white woman, you know, I don't think it would have gone down that way.
Well, there's also this lace of that she was from Chicago and that her family was from Chicago. And they came down and they were... Pardon my language. I can say this because I'm black. They were being uppity with this white police force. That's sort of a little bit laced through Sandra's story. And because when she's stopped, she is talking to the officers, but she's challenging him. She's challenging him a bit about, well, why are you doing this to me? And I'm going to take you to court. She says that repeatedly. Yeah. I can't, which is sort of sad and ironic that she thought the courts were the thing that was going to help her in this situation.
Yeah.
And that just, for whatever, you know.
Yeah, but that traffic stop gets mischaracterized pretty quickly because it ends really dramatically. And it does end.
Absolutely.
It does end with Sandy saying, you know.
You're hurting me.
You know, yeah. She's dropping the F-bomb over and over. I'll spare your bleeper, the thing. So, but it actually begins with the officer pulling her over and says, give me your license and registration. And without saying a thing, she goes, here you go. He comes back 5 minutes later. He's writing up a little warning. She's not saying anything. He says, you look irritated. And so she says, well, yeah, I am irritated. You pulled me over for no reason. You were tailing me. I pull over. So, yeah, I'm irritated. That doesn't stop you from giving me a ticket. She gets quiet again. He then says, are you done? Now, as Katie and I have said, because as you mentioned, we're husband and wife.
Tone.
You know, if I'm grousing at Katie about something and she says, are you done? You know, we all know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
So she says, yeah, I'm done. And that's it. And then he says, would you mind putting out your cigarette? She says, well, I do mind. And then he says, get out of the car. And that's when she goes, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm. So I think that when she does, as you say, you know, finally sort of loses it at him verbally, that, you know, that comes from a buildup.
Of course.
You know, actually, I might add, you know, decades and decades of sort of legacy of, you know, being a black person who knows in America that it's a much more difficult and potentially dangerous and, you know, sort of the treatment is so unfair on the road compared to how most officers treat Caucasians. Mm-hmm. And so she was really frustrated at that point and knew that things were going south fast. And it was not, I agree with David, really her doing. She was very polite and you know, he was egging her, he was baiting her. And I think that's hard to dispute.
Yeah.
So her biggest sin was taking the bait.
Yeah.
She shouldn't have.
Now, remember, she's also a political, you know, she's an activist by nature, and you get to know her in the film in a way that's quite surprising because she left a legacy of video blogs, right?
Yeah, that's what I want to ask you about. I want to play a little bit. This is one of the really interesting and a really great texture in the film is that months prior to this horrible incident, she had just sort of found her activist voice, her political voice, and started this blog called Sandy Speaks, addressing just in the most eerily prescient ways things that were going to be in her future. So let's take a little listen to an episode of Sandy Speaks.
Through Sandy Speaks, we are going to open up a gateway for the kids, educating them on interacting with police. I don't think it's ever too early. And if you're a cop out there and you're watching this, here's your chance to say something and educate these kids. Because again, I'm here to change history. This thing that I'm holding in my hand, this telephone, this camera, it is quite powerful. Social media is powerful. We can do something with this. If we want to change, we can really, truly make it happen. Sandy Speaks.
When did she become politically active, and what were her goals? You watched her Sandy Speaks series.
Yeah. Oh, sure. You know, she became politically active right in I think, 2014, 2015, right when the country had experienced this spate of police shootings, you know, Laquan McDonald in Chicago, closest to home. You know, when I listen to that clip, it just reminds me. I mean, Sandy's character was so full of optimism and hope, and she saw this terrible political impasse that the country was in, you know, white versus black, really everybody hating on each other and going, wait a minute, you know, we have to do something to change this. We can't just complain about it. We have to talk to people. We have to educate each other. And she talks about how black people don't have enough white friends and white people don't have enough black friends. And we demonize each other. And if we don't start talking, you know, we're doomed to repeat this cycle forever.
We're speaking with David Hubrunner and Kate Davis about their documentary Say Her Name about Sandra Bland. We're going to continue this conversation after the break. We'll find out a little bit about how David and Kate talked to the local authorities and got them to be in the film, as well as some of the more difficult footage you'll see in the film and why it was important to include it. Stay with us. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guests are David Heilbrunner and Kate Davis, the documentary filmmakers who've made Say Her Name. You can catch it on HBO On Demand. It's about the life of Sandra Bland and the death of Sandra Bland. So, David, you're an attorney.
Yeah, I'm
you're a former prosecutor.
I plead guilty, Your Honor. Yeah.
So in terms of getting law enforcement and getting the local DA and the sheriff to get to talk to you guys, because they get a fair amount of time in the film. Talk to us a little bit about that process.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, it's really important almost to honor Sandy's vision that we were talking about earlier about, you know, black and white. You can't, we're too polarized. The kinds of, I don't want films that are just a single point of view diatribe. The country doesn't, certainly we don't need that right now. So we really wanted the Texas authorities, and we knew it was going to be a hard get because they had been demonized right from the jump. You know, they were immediately labeled as murderers, intentional murderers, you know, before all the evidence was in. And they felt very defensive. I'm thinking that one of our selling points was, you know, was our background, not just the films, but the fact that I was a prosecutor. There is this sense in law enforcement of once you've worked in that world, and I have, you get it. Mm-hmm. And you have a certain understanding about what the pressures are that the public doesn't get. And I think that's true. Doesn't mean I approve of what happened, and doesn't mean I approve of what they say in the film, but it's really important we listen to their point of view and get it. And I think they felt that we were going to do that, and I believe we did that in the film.
No, I understand that. I hear media stories about this person did this horrible thing behind the scenes, and having been in media, you know, like, well, I know that probably that person had this lawyer and that person. You know what the pressures are.
Yeah, totally.
You know what the circumstances are, the time and place of it doesn't make you, I mean, you endorse it or think it's right, but you understand how things work.
Yeah, quite. I mean, that's right. And that's, for example, I mean, when Officer Insignia goes up to the car to talk to Sandy, I'm aware that from the police officer's point of view, that's a scary place to be. It's scary because it doesn't matter what the color of the occupant of the car is. You're going up to a stranger who you've just stopped, and there are people out there with guns and knives and mace, and or maybe they're just going to speed off and leave you in the dust. I mean, it's and every single time is you're dealing with a total stranger, a total unknown. So I was giving people a little bit of benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. I mean, the problem in this case is that they had been talking for about 7-8 minutes before he gets really nasty and pulls a taser. There's no reason he's not trying to defend himself. But so, you know, I was open to hearing what they had to say.
And what's interesting is once we did work with them, I mean, they actually admit some failings, you know, in the system. And I think that's really important for audiences to hear, too, that they are willing to look at themselves down in Waller County at what went down with Sandra's case and what could have been done differently and how they may have been culpable to a certain degree. So, I mean, the film hopefully just is a crack of dialogue where we can, you know, begin to evaluate for ourselves what in the system is broken, you know, and how we might be able to work with each other to change things.
One of the things about the film that is moving and is important to not look away from is a lot of the really difficult footage. The dash cam, we've seen it, it's difficult. But in the film, there are photographs of parts of Sandra's body. There are photographs of the cell. There's this photograph of the trash bag noose. I know you didn't use everything you had. Why was it important for you to use some of the more graphic imagery?
Well, I think it was critical for an audience to feel on a visceral level the loss of Sandra's life, you know, that this is when you see a part of an inert body on the floor of a cold jail cell, that's harsh. Yeah, it is disturbing, but it should be disturbing. And I felt that if we had sanitized it too much and kind of you never saw those things, you only heard her very lively, vibrant voice through her videos, that the film would do a disservice to the tragedy, in a sense. So it was important to look at some of the, you know, the reality visually. On the other hand, we had to make some tough choices, and we did leave out most of what we had in terms of the evidence. But it's an investigation. It's a really dramatic unfolding of, you know, discovery over the course of a year and a half of with this legal team and the family. And so that was also part of it. The film is, you know, a bit of a, you know, a kind of thriller of sorts. And so that also is important, that people get how the forensic details, how important they were in the deep attempt on the part of the family to figure out what happened to their loved one.
Yeah, they hired an independent coroner, and you actually follow that. We're in the room with the coroner as she's working to figure out and find answers.
That's
it's
right.
Crazy, yeah.
And I think even more, it's funny, the visual graphics I get, and there's sort of that history of Emmett Till, you know, you open the casket, you show what went down. But what I have to give the family credit for, and I think the film really gives... Talk about intimacy in the film. They allowed us into a scene where this independent investigator they had hired was for the first time telling the family and their lawyers, you know, what she actually believed happened to Sandy. And she's going over the details of what she found in her autopsy. And the family is profoundly upset. But, you know, they let the cameras roll and they showed it. And I think for me, you know, those are harder to watch than crime scene photos for me.
One of the things there are many interesting things, but is the evolution of the family over the course of these years that you follow them from people who are grieving to activists themselves. What did you witness?
Well, you know, Geneva Reed Veal, who is the matriarch of the family, that's Sandy's mom. There were five daughters, all whose names begin with S, which was already a learning curve for us. but Geneva was and remains a preacher. She'd actually studied ministry. So she... you know, regained her voice a little bit at the end of this. One of the scenes in the film is she goes to the Congressional Black Caucus, right, and talks to a new generation of kids, picking up the baton that Sandy had originally raised and, I guess, sort of posthumously tossed off to her. You know, the families right now, they really have never really had a chance to grieve until this last year when we were editing the film. Mm-hmm. So it's been an evolution, and it's never going to be easy for them. You know, the notion of closure in these kinds of situations is almost ridiculous. You don't have closure from the loss of a beloved sister or a daughter. You know, you learn to get along. You learn to find something to fight for, but the wounds don't close.
No, but they are, as you say, they have become activists. They are all, each and every one of them, extraordinarily strong-minded and articulate and compassionate, and they speak for other siblings and other families who've lost their family members at the hands of police or in police custody. And so, yeah, there's a lot of sort of to be learned from them as they speak across the country and take out this film. And also for them, it can only be cathartic, you know, and to make something good out of this loss.
Did anything change on the local level there as a result of Sandra's death?
Yeah, I mean, the family, at the end of the film, you'll see they reach a settlement with the local authorities. Part of the settlement was a promise of legislation to address two things, the way inmates are treated in prison and police de-escalation, that cops have to learn to de-escalate these situations in the first place. Because honestly, if Trooper Insignia had behaved like a way a cop ought to behave, Sandy would be here now, period. Mm-hmm. So what happened was they went to the legislature, and the legislature enacted half of that. they required that all jail cells have cameras. They required that you can't get away with these fraudulent jail checks. You actually have to push a button and show that you were there. And they also had said a nurse has to be on staff to deal with people's mental and physical well-being.
Called the Sandra Bland Act, by the way.
True. It's entitled the Sandra Bland Act. What they did not do, what they stripped from the bill, is police de-escalation, which, you know, pissed the family off mightily, as it should have, given it was part of the promise of the settlement.
The name of the film is Say Her Name, The Life and Death of Sandra Bland. Kate Davis and David Heilbronner, thank you so much for joining us and for walking us through the film.
Thank you very
pleasure.
Much.
Thanks. Yeah.
This is All of It on WNYC. We'll be right back. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. The fall issue of the Columbia Journalism Review is dedicated to one subject: who reports the news and why it matters. The edition is called The Race Issue, Unfinished, The Stories Left Untold in America's Newsrooms. The word unfinished is really important because this is an old, stubborn problem. Just listen to this passage from the Kerner Commission, formed when LBJ was president. It was charged with investigating the causes of the urban unrest that had swept across America in the mid-1960s. Quote, "The journalistic profession has been shockingly backward in seeking out, hiring, training, and promoting Negroes. Tokenism, the hiring of one Negro reporter, or even two or three, is no longer enough. Negro reporters are essential, but so are Negro editors, writers, and commentators. Newspaper and television policies are, generally speaking, not set by reporters. Editorial decisions about which stories to cover and which to use are made by editors. Yet very few Negroes in this country are involved in making these decisions because very few, if any, supervisory editorial jobs are held by Negroes. We urge the news media to do everything possible to train and promote their Negro reporters to positions where those who are qualified can contribute to and have an effect on policy decisions." Believe it or not, that media critique is 50 years old, and all of that is still true. For example, in 2017, the American Society of News Editors found that 17% of employees at print and online news outlets were Latino or non-white. The number is close to 40% of the general population. There's a lot to talk about it. Kyle Pope's here, and Jelani Cobb is here. Jelani is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the Ira A. Lippman Professor of Journalism at Columbia University, and Kyle is the magazine's editor and publisher. Thanks for coming in, you all.
Thanks for having us.
Mm-hmm. So, Kyle, what made you feel like now was the time to have this edition?
Well, it's interesting that you started talking about the Kerner Commission report, because that's something that the 50th anniversary of that got some attention, and you know, I started going to some events that were sort of commemorating that. I was actually surprised how much of the report was about the media.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, you pointed out the relevant passage, which was like, this really has to be addressed. And it's been a sort of frustration of mine for the last couple of years, how accepting people are of the kind of stasis when it comes to diversity in the media. Like, this stuff hasn't moved in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, you know, for a place like the Columbia Journalism Review, which is all about sort of trying to watchdog the press, sort of trying to explore why we seem to be stuck was worth our time. We haven't devoted, and the magazine goes back to 1961. It's never devoted a whole issue to this. So I just thought it was incredibly important. And I got to tell you, the process was frustrating.
What was frustrating about it?
Well, I mean, the sort of collective shrug that you get from a lot of places. I mean, there's a lot here that we can talk about, but you know, the fact that there is this, you know, basically 20-point disparity between the makeup of the country and the makeup of newsrooms. And it's even worse depending on what market you're looking at. And, you know, there's a level of frustration that you hear from news people, which is like, basically, we really want to do something about this, but the economy is really terrible. We're not growing jobs. We're not replacing people. So it's really hard to move the needle. But you know, you quickly realize that when things were great, they weren't doing anything either.
Right.
So we're really trying to understand, like, why does there seem to be this reluctance? And that's what we really tried to probe.
So Jelani, as guest editor of The Race Issue, how did you go about putting it together? What was important for you to touch on?
So I had to take a really arduous trip to the CJR offices, which are all the way upstairs.
In the same building downstairs.
All the way upstairs from my office. So Kyle and I had been in a series of different conversations, and I say different, like, I mean, on various subjects relating to journalism since I got there in 2016. And then at the point at which I became director of the Ira A. Lippman Center, which is specifically around journalism and civil and human rights, Kyle said, you know, look, we're doing this thing, and it'd be great if we collaborated between these two initiatives that have a, you know, significant overlap right now at this mm-hmm. at this particular issue. And so from there, it kind of followed the same sort of standard, you know, trajectory. We sat down and there was the pitch meeting and people had ideas, and we kind of went back and forth on, you know, what were the hot button things that we had to talk about, and, you know, what were the things that would kind of like fill out the, mm-hmm. the issue, and went from there.
What do you think are the big hot button issues, the three big ones?
Well, one has always been the kind of historical part of it. We had the same kind of beginning at the Kerner. We were actually on an event together on Kerner. The other, I thought, was really the way in which media has become so much of, has been in the firing line itself, and the dynamics that are associated with that are not unrelated to race, mm-hmm. And who is in the media and so on. And I've mentioned that in my piece. And then in addition, there's, I think, the kind of persistence of it, like these conversations of how even like year after year, decade after decade, we have the same sort of conversation and you get lots of, you know, verbal commitment, but then like nothing really happens. And
what is the gap between the verbal commitment and nothing really happens? Like, what? Why don't those two things connect?
I think, go ahead.
Well, okay, I think there are a few things, right? There are, I guess, the most benign version of this, which is that people are relying upon their own networks of people. They mm-hmm. call the people who they went to school with and their social networks, even if people have examined, like, their social networks tend to look like they do. Mm-hmm. And so you never get anyone from outside that small circle, and that's self-replicating. The other side of it is that people are aware that they have to say that this is important, but it really isn't. It's like the old "don't tell me your priorities, show me your budget" mm-hmm. line. And I mean, I think that's part of it as well. And then, I mean, I've been in conversations where people have said things like, "Well, you know, I think it's just as important that we have ideological diversity," and I just want to jump out the window every time someone says that. And I was like, "Well," and I was like, and you know, a person pointed out, it's like, "We don't have very many conservative viewpoints," and I was like, "Yeah, we've never had Jim Crow for conservatives in this country either." Like, yeah. There's a kind of idea, and certainly you do want to have a spectrum of opinions, but these things don't come from the same place, and they don't have the same sort of implications.
I'm curious if the Trump administration, specifically this president's language and actions, led you to think this was an important issue to cover at this time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that race in America has become the story since, well, it's long been a story, but Trump has really made us, all of us, think about this in a frank way. We around the time of the Charlottesville protests and what happened afterwards, we really got engaged in fact, we had an event in Charlottesville where we brought in a lot of people to talk about journalism and race. And we started to get really focused on, you know, things like what kind of language is appropriate to use when you're talking about mm-hmm. somebody like Trump. And, you know, wrote an editorial about how, you know, using words like racially tinged and racially charged doesn't work anymore. And then we just have to say racist if that's what this is. And it just became clear that this was an area that a lot of media organizations were muddling their way through in terms of the stories, in terms of the way they were covering the stories. And it also became clear that their inability to get their heads around this was directly related to their own makeups of their own newsrooms. Mm-hmm. You can't separate one from the other. Go ahead.
Oh, can I add one other thing to the earlier point? The makeups of their own newsrooms. I do think that there's another dynamic in this, which is that people generally want to feel that they got to where they got, where they are, through their own merit and through their own hard work. Mm-hmm. And if you're pointing to this other group of people who aren't there and saying that somehow or another they've been kept out, it makes people uncomfortable to say, well, the playing field wasn't level. I had these advantages. Even if I worked hard, I, you know, mm-hmm. took these classes, I went to graduate school, or whatever the route was, it is not the most comfortable thought to think that there's someone else who was as good as you, God forbid, even better at this than you might be, who never got into that arena. And so some of the pushback that you get from people is kind of a self-interested mm-hmm. pushback, like, hey, I got to where I am through my own diligence and, you know, I took out student loans and so on, and that kind of narrative. And so the presumption is that if you're trying to diversify, you're saying that you should have a kind of giveaway. And that's, even if that's not what you're saying, a lot of times that's what people hear, I think. And that's part of like the friction.
Yeah. I'm going to share a personal story. One time I was up for this really big job and the person said, well, you know, everybody who gets this job has been a White House reporter. And I'm 52. So I was like, a black woman who was a White House reporter 25 years ago was a unicorn. Mm-hmm. They didn't exist. Mm-hmm. Right. So you've told me that there's no black woman can get this job if that's the box that needs to be checked.
Mm-hmm. That's a grandfather clause.
Yeah, exactly. And it was incredibly frustrating that, you know, I just couldn't get past that point.
Mm-hmm. And what did they say when you said that?
Just kind of gave me the look. Mm-hmm. You know?
I know that look.
I just got the look.
The look with a capital T.
I got the look of, well, it's better now. I got the it's better now.
Right.
So we're talking to Jelani Cobb and Kyle Pope about the CJR cover story. It's actually the fall edition. The race issue is called Unfinished. The story is left untold in America's newsroom. So Jelani, just tell us very, you know, people who are listening saying, I don't understand practically how this makes a difference in the news I read. You write about that in your essay. How does it practically make a difference in a story that you might read about a bank robbery, for example?
So, yeah, I talk about this. It was a story that was in the New York Times, and I've actually given that story to my students. And it was interesting for a couple of reasons, one of which was that it involved a spate of robberies in a neighborhood that I'd lived very close to when I was in graduate school. And they wrote, you know, about the inscrutable habit people have of not giving up their money. And it was a very condescending, like patronizing approach to the story. And having lived in that neighborhood, I was just looking at all of the things that were missing. And that, you know, the reporter was white, the person who they quoted, you know, the expert that they quoted was white, but the people who lived in this community were all black or Latino, or overwhelmingly black and Latino. And so I said, there are dynamics to this that might not be apparent to you if you are a middle-class white person, but would be very apparent to you if you were a lower-income or working-class person of color. And, like, namely, that if someone doesn't give up, you know, their money, even a person's, you know, being held at gunpoint, they're not worried about being robbed that time. They're being worried about the time after that and the time after that and the time after that, that their neighborhood will become essentially uninhabitable for them. And so that was a kind of technical point on it. But to me, it opened up into this much broader issue of vantage point. And so when we're talking about having a diverse newsroom, what we're really saying is that you should have a diverse number of vantage points, people who come to stories from different places. And also, notably, I mentioned David Carr in there, the late David Carr from the New York Times, but more personally connected to me, to my interest, was the Washington City paper, where he was the editor-in-chief, and he hired me. He also hired my good friend Ta-Nehisi Coates. We came in the same year as interns. And David did this. He came into a paper that did not have a great track record on diversity. And he set about diversifying the paper for the best possible reason, which is that he was afraid that there were stories he was missing. And he wanted all the stories that he could get. And he was like, I'm hiring you because I want you all to increase the surface area of this paper.
He was a great man.
Yeah, he was.
He really was. Yeah. He was character, too. Mm-hmm. The name of it is The Race Issue, Unfinished, The Stories Left Untold in America's Newsrooms. We'll continue this conversation with Jelani Cobb and Kyle Pope after a quick break. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. In studio, we have Jelani Cobb and Kyle Pope. Jelani was the guest editor on the Columbia Journalism Review's Race Issue, Unfinished, The Stories Left Untold in America's Newsrooms. And Kyle Pope is the editor-in-chief and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. So, Kyle, you sent 10 reporters into newsrooms around the country with a distinct mismatch between the makeup of the staff and the demographics in the area. And you talked to newsroom managers and editors. Can you share what you found out?
Yeah, I mean, we get back to what we were talking about in terms of trying to understand why this needle hasn't moved. And the one frustrating word that we kept using over and over, we kept hearing over and over again, which became a kind of like frustrating punchline in the office, was pipeline. It's the pipeline. It's the pipeline. It's the pipeline.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah. And you're like, no more pipeline. Because it became obvious that it was just an excuse. It was an excuse that people didn't really bother unpacking. One of the most sort of surprising things that we found, and that frankly was one of the more depressing, was we visited a couple of digital-only, digital-first newsrooms. which were new, and you would think, you know, didn't have a lot of these legacy problems.
The BuzzFeeds of the world.
Well, no, it was one was in Hawaii, and we visited another one in Denver. Same problem, if not worse. Similarly, if you look at some of the big digital players that you just talked about, when HuffPost is in here and BuzzFeed is in here, same problems. So what that tells me is that this is not a, it's not a relic of a time. It's a current, persistent, continuing problem.
What does pipeline mean to you when you hear that, Jelani?
When I hear pipeline, it's usually kind of we've stopped trying. Generally. Mm-hmm. And now, they're also, if you're going to actually say this, like, you know, in some instances you'll say there are not very many people of color who are in, like, this particular field. But I always say, then, are you doing anything to change that balance? Because for a very long time, like lots of these professions, there were closed doors. And, you know, what we're dealing with is the legacy of those issues mm-hmm. in the present. And so, kind of looking at where journalism is, and especially some of the things I think that are inscrutable, where you have publications where there are sizable numbers of people of color, but they somehow or another don't show up on the staff of your publication, especially where there are universities, there are journalism majors, there are English majors, there are communications majors, that are all these people, but they never quite seem to make it across town to mm-hmm. try to recruit some of those folk. And so it doesn't get very far with me. Like, that might be an obstacle, but I don't think it's an excuse.
Especially in a city that's near an HBCU.
Right.
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 Just go, they're right there.
Just go across town, yeah.
I remember once somebody asked me this very, very earnestly, an editor at a big magazine, said, what can we do? What can we do as one of these diversity meetings? And I said, you know, everything's about internships in media, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what is the biggest obstacle to internships? Housing. Mm-hmm. Finding, being able to afford mm-hmm. to come to New York, LA, Chicago, and, you know, if you could just find a way for people to, you know, if they want to, you know, wait tables to for their beer money, that's fine. But to be able to be in this city, you would get such a different pool of interns, mm-hmm. and then you would have a different. That's your pipeline. Mm-hmm. Your pipeline's got to start somewhere.
Mm. Yeah, I think that I should mention that the way that I came into the Washington City Paper was through a paid internship. Because
it's a huge difference.
Huge difference, because what you wind up doing, and I remember there was a publication, I don't want to put them on the spot, but it, you know, it was Harper's. And, and I was like,
how do you spell that?
I think it's H-A. But so they had an intern program, and as a young person, a college student, I consumed every issue of Harper's from the beginning to the index to the end. And then I found that their internship program was unpaid in New York City. So basically it meant you were only going to replicate those people whose parents could afford to pay for them to be in New York City for however long that was.
Kyle, the magazine contains a story about a former WNYC culture editor, Gisele Rigato. Did I say her
Rigato,
name?
Rigato, yeah.
Rigato, thank you. Can you share her story?
Yeah. So she's a freelance writer who's done a lot of radio and TV work, and she grew up in Brazil, and she was really interested in a profile or a story about a show involving a well-known Brazilian artist who was really breaking out in the U.S. So she approached NPR about doing this piece, and they went back and forth, and the person that she corresponded with basically said, well, I think it's worthwhile, except, although I'm concerned about your accent. And she was like, well, I didn't really think that would be a thing. And then he rattled off a couple of other things that would also be of concern, like it's hard to do arts coverage on the radio, which is not true.
Mm-hmm. It's 2 hours a day live, everybody.
She sort of started to engage this question about, like, well, who do you want, what do you want the radio to sound like? And who do you want it to sound like? And what do you want it to represent in terms of what people hear? And she eventually talked to this person. She talked to other people at NPR. She talked to other radio reporters around the country. And this is a huge thing. And it really affected her. I mean, she obviously knew that she, and we had her on to talk to her in a podcast, and she obviously knew she had an accent, but it never really, until that incident, it hadn't hit her as a severe as impediment to her professional growth as she realized it was. Mm-hmm. To their credit, I guess, NPR apologized to her through our story, told her that this wasn't the way that they operated. And she said, well, thank you. That's interesting. So who else with accents do you have on the radio now? Mm-hmm. And they had a hard time answering the question.
And we should say, that's National Public Radio, yeah. Not WNYC. We're just going to point that out for the moment. When you hear a story like that, Jelani, where I don't even know what the question is. I guess what role do accents play in this whole discussion?
I mean, I think it's a signifier. Excuse me. It's a signifier in a lot of ways that, and again, we go back to the same thing of like, when you have an idea in mind of who the person for this position is, you either subconsciously or conscientiously screen out anyone that doesn't fit that mold. And so, notwithstanding the fact that there are lots of people in the United States who have accents from various other places, or that there are people who are saying that, you know, you could hear, especially in the story that she's referencing, the accent gives a kind of air of authenticity, mm-hmm. in terms of what she's referencing, or a lot of ways of interpreting that. But it doesn't necessarily go that far if it's just kind of, we want the standard white male, preferably, if anything, Midwestern or non-regional enunciation, and that's what we want radio to sound like. And you could say the same thing about who we think should be in front of a camera, mm-hmm. or who we think should be sitting at, you know, an anchor desk, or who we think should be out reporting or interviewing people. And it goes on again and again and again. It's like all the ways of the various tributaries that end up producing that 20-point gap that we were just talking about at the top of the show.
I like the story because it's a very obvious and visceral manifestation of all of this. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, it's literally the voices in our journalism, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought it was a terrific piece and something that I hadn't thought enough about.
And also interesting that people were upfront with her to say it, because
they felt comfortable enough to say that.
Right. But very often they never tell you exactly what it was anyway. And you're just going like from place to place to place, knowing that there's something happening, but you're not quite sure what it is.
Mm. How do you think the 2016 presidential election would have been different had newsrooms been more balanced?
So there was, I mentioned this in you know, what I wrote in the issue. There was this frustrating cult of euphemism about what was happening in 2016. It was economic anxiety, or all of these populism, where people were referring to things that were egregiously racist or wildly misogynistic, and no one could seem to call it on its face what it was. And there were a number of people who were, you know, writing, very many of them people of color, saying, that's not what this is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mentioned Nicole Hannah-Jones was one, Adam Serwer at The Atlantic was another, Jamel Bowie at Slate, Ta-Nehisi Coates, also at The Atlantic at the time. And people were saying, like, look, these dynamics are very much related to the fact that there was an African-American president, and there's a reactionary push in the opposite direction. And now, of course, you know, political scientists and pollsters and people have bolstered that racial resentment was a huge part of what was happening. Mm-hmm. But I think that the culture of newsrooms in which people could not or were reluctant to confront exactly what was going on, and there weren't, in many instances, people of color or people of color who were being listened to, who had the kind of seniority in those positions to actually say, like, we need to at least explore these other questions. And the net result was that until we wind up with something like Charlottesville, which is undeniable, like, at every step along the way, people are just going like, this is curious. And then you go like, how did we get here? And so it sometimes has, you have the feeling of like running face first into a wall, mm-hmm. and saying, well, it's very obvious, if we've been willing to pay attention, it's very obvious how we got to this place.
before I let you go, got about 45 seconds. Do you see anything positive in your, any sense that things could get better? And show. No.
I don't.
You didn't. That's a perfectly fair
Do you know what's
answer.
Positive? Do you know what's positive? What's positive is the talented pool of people we were able to find to come together and talk about this issue.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. There you go. It is The Race Issue Unfinished, the stories left untold in America's newsrooms. Kyle Pope and Jelani Cobb, thank you so much for joining us here on All of It.
Thank you.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to All of It. Join us tomorrow at noon on WNYC. You can follow All of It on Instagram and Twitter at All of It WNYC. Thanks for listening.